Guardian Unlimited.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Haycast. I'm Safraz Manzor with your bite-sized guide to the best of the hay festival. Now, the rain's pretty much pelted down all day, but if you think that's going to be dampening the enthusiasm of the hardy haygoer, think again. Ruth Rendell, Simon Sharma and Billy Bragg were just some of the speakers entertaining in the rain. On today's programme, Dave Eggers on his non-fiction novel about the life of a Sudanese refugee. There's more food for thought as we look at what and where festival goers have been eating. Plus, we have Ian Rankin on 20 years of Inspector Rebus. That's all ahead, but first, here's what visitors to the festival have already seen.
The best thing was probably Alexander McCall-Smith yesterday morning.
Best thing was probably Eric Hobsbawm last night.
He's just really, really funny and just very witty and just generally hilarious. And it was just interesting to learn about sort of how he wrote his novels and how engaged he was with his various characters across all the series that he writes.
The worst thing, I suppose, was last night David Mitchell's. Yes, surprise, surprise, because there was so much reading. And Peter Ho and David read for about 25 minutes, where I'd much prefer more question and answer or interviewing of the authors.
Probably the worst thing for me, although I enjoyed it, was the Eric Hobsbawm thing because it was quite dry and I found it quite hard to kind of follow.
It's only 10 o'clock in the morning, so there's a bit of an early rise to see Steve Bell, the Guardian cartoonist, and the best part was how he described Tony Blair, which was by focusing on the eyes and having one mad left eye and right soft sparkly eye. And when you look at all the cartoons that he's done of Tony Blair since, you really see it and you see why it stands out and why they're so striking.
Now, the American writer Dave Eggers first shot to fame with his memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. The book explored the author's struggle to raise his younger brother following the sudden death of their parents. Eggers' latest book, What is the What?, is also a memoir, but not of himself, rather of Valentino Acek Deng. Told in the first person, the book tells Deng's story from being separated from his family during the Sudan Civil War to his journey to America, where he becomes what's known as one of the Lost Boys. I spoke to Valentino Acek Deng and Dave Eggers, and I began by asking Dave what first inspired him to write the book.
I was just a casual reader of the Lost Boys story in the American media. There were a bunch of stories that appeared in 2000 and 2001 after the 4,000 young men were resettled in cities all over the country. And I just read articles in the magazines. And it wasn't until 2002 I got a letter in the mail from Mary Williams, the head of the Lost Boys Foundation in Atlanta. And she was the one that directly asked me to be involved and to help Valentino write his story.
Now, Valentino, you were one of the Lost Boys. For people who don't know, these were people who were taken away out of Sudan, given a chance to have refugee status in America, but you were all just young, without parents, without families.
Yes, many of us were young, but not up to the point when we went to the U.S. We were already young men. Many of us were more than 18 years of age and had grown to believe that living by themselves and without family was a reality they had to face. And the main things to do was to be able to be comfortable in the U.S. and try to reconnect with our families back in Sudan.
And a chance to grow up very quickly.
Yes, it was a chance to grow up quickly and a chance to grasp many things and learn a lot at the same time. It was a new society.
Now tell me about, there was a moment where you are burgled, aren't you? And there is this theme, this idea that you need to tell your story. Why did you think that telling your story was important?
There were so many stories written in the news and in media about the Sudan and this so-called Lost Boys of Sudan, but conflict was ongoing back in our country, and I saw the need to share my experience with the world as a microcosm of millions of lives in Sudan that were in jeopardy.
Dave, there are different ways that one can express interest. You can do a story, you can make an appearance. You wanted to really immerse yourself in this story.
Not at first. I went to Atlanta really just thinking I was going to meet Valentino and meet Mary and meet some of the other Lost Boys who were resettled there and spend the weekend and just learn more. I really didn't make any commitment when I went out there. Valentino wanted his biography written, and after we spent that weekend sort of recording his story and talking a lot, it became clear that we got along very well and we had the same goals for the book if it were going to become a reality. But I think it was still many months after that that I finally really made a solid commitment, like, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to see it through and however long it takes. And I had no idea it would take quite as long as it did.
But is it an act purely of the fact that you are interested in this particular story and you want to highlight it? What, as a writer and as somebody who is creative, what do you get out of this particular project?
Man, it changed a lot over those years. At first I was really just going to be a oral historian, really, and try to assemble it, because I do a lot of oral history editing and I have a way of trying to assemble a story so it's compelling. And it changed many times. And maybe for a while I was writing it as a journalist and in the third person. But I can't say it was always artistically fun at all, because I was giving myself up to the story and trying to remove myself and my voice. And
there must have been masses of material.
Yeah, trying to assimilate everything that Valentino was telling me and connect it with the history of the Civil War and the history of the Southern Sudan and the causes of the war, and trying to make that all, you know, part of a piece and make it make sense to a mainstream reader was really difficult. It wasn't a whole lot of fun. It was fun when we were together.
But did the writing, you guys talk, or was it mostly on the phone? How did you get your story to Dave?
We recorded the story. We talked on the phone. We exchanged emails. We met. We went to Sudanese parties together. We attended Dave's wedding together. There were so many things we did, which were in part a process of the book and in part also a process that allowed us to open up to each other among ourselves and to also get acquainted with each other.
But in terms of opening up, the memories you're dragging up and revealing are very painful. I mean, the childhood you're talking about is full of violence. It's in terms of attacks and murders, etc. This is painful material to be dragging up, isn't it?
Of course. I had lost my childhood. And not only did I lose that, I wandered alone in the wilderness. I starved. I saw death around me. I was thirsty. I saw a very close friend died. And this was a very painful story to relive. It was my purpose, it was my goal to make sure that I have told this story and that this story will be a microcosm of many things that have happened in Sudan, including the Darfur genocide today. It was a goal that I do not want to abandon. That is what encouraged me to relive my life again. It was not easy that I recall incidences where I might have saw a woman die or dead and her child trying to breastfeed on her, but it was okay to do it.
The responsibility of literary ventriloquism is quite a great one when you're dealing with this kind of material.
I think so. I mean, that was the sort of, when we got started, I made a commitment. You know, I made a promise that I would finish it, and I also thought I would finish it within a year. And we knew that it would have an impact, and also that any proceeds from the book would go to Valentino, and he would use them to help his town. And the sense of duty and responsibility to not only Valentino as a subject of a book, but also as a friend, was pretty incredible. I'd never really lived with that before. But also sort of getting it right for not just Valentino, but, the 4,000 other Lost Boys and also everyone else, that Valentino had known and lost. And we were both very sensitive and very, acutely aware of that sense of responsibility all the way through. And we really made sure we got it right.
Dave Eggers and Valentino Acek Deng speaking to me earlier.
Hello, I'm Ian Rankin, and you're listening to The Guardian's Haycast.
All around Hay, the restaurants and cafes have been fit to bursting. That's partly because everybody just wants to get out of the rain, but it's also because staggering from one tent to another can be hungry work. So we wanted to know what people have been eating and where they like to dine out.
We always go to a very unsatisfactory place because it's always empty.
Of course, this is a very nice place. Escari's has got a very good reputation. And we might, if I can persuade my wife to waste our time, we'll probably come here.
We have a small van, a camper van, which we're staying in. And so we're cooking ourselves. And we've been eating. We did eat last night down in the town. And it wasn't very good. In fact, it was awful.
And I think this is the sort of place where one can indulge oneself. Don't you agree?
I've had Tyrrell's crisps and ice cream.
I had beans, bacon, sausage, egg, tomato, mushrooms and a coffee.
So I thought I'd get a cup of tea and the bacon burger was too much to resist.
I've had two very nice cups of coffee. Quite pleased with that the prices aren't too high, because usually when I come here, we go into town and I thought things here might be a bit more expensive, but actually they're not too bad.
And those look like good burgers, are they?
Very good, yes, very good, thank you.
How did you choose what to eat today?
That's a good question, yeah. Most things seem to be quite expensive, and we're here for the weekend, so we didn't want to blow the whole budget on the first afternoon.
I'm Greg Morris. We run Extreme Organics. We've been coming to Hay Festival for since we started the business.
Has it been busy this afternoon?
Oh, yes, yeah. At dinner time, it just went mad. It's just loads of people.
What do you do when it gets like that?
Well, we just work our way through it. I'm afraid people just have to wait a bit longer.
Just ordinary coffee with cold milk, fine. Yeah. You know, just sort of not cappuccino type thing.
I own a company called Ooh La La Catering, based in Cheltenham, and we're an event and fine dining event company.
What's the most popular thing here? What have people really been going for?
Yesterday I was staggered about how much food's going on. The barbecue in the evening, everybody loves the barbecue in the evening. The paninis that we're selling here, they're flying out. They're more popular than the sandwiches, and the sandwiches are cheaper. And the coffee, I just can't keep up. I've got a dairy literally down the road, literally milking cows this morning to supply us. So a panini and a latte is going down very well.
In the 20 years since he began writing his Inspector Rebus novels, Ian Rankin has become something of a household name, and Rebus one of literature's most iconic figures. He's put both crime fiction and Edinburgh on the literary map, and as Rebus nears retirement, millions of readers will be fearing the end. Guardian Unlimited's books editor, Sarah Crown, spoke to Ian Rankin, and he started by introducing a reading from his latest book, The Naming of the Dead.
Rebus and his colleague Siobhan are at Gleneagles Hotel during the G8 Conference of World Leaders, and they're waiting for a lift back to Edinburgh. Rebus had lit a cigarette. He heard a sound and turned to see a bicycle round the corner of the hotel. Its rider was bent low, aiming for speed, another bike tucked in directly behind. The leading cyclist passed within 30 feet, caught sight of them, and offered a wave. Rebus gave a flick of his cigarette in acknowledgement, but lifting his fingers from the handlebars had unbalanced the rider. His front wheel wobbled, slewing across the gravel. The other cyclist tried to avoid him, but ended up going over his own handlebars. Men in dark suits arrived as if from nowhere, making a rapid huddle around the two sprawled figures. "Did we just do that?" Siobhan asked quietly. Rebus said nothing, just dumped a cigarette and eased himself back into the car. Siobhan followed his example, and they watched through the windscreen as the first cyclist was helped to his feet, rubbing his grazed knuckles. The other rider was still on the ground, but no one seemed to be paying him much heed. A question of protocol, Rebus guessed. The needs of President George W. Bush must always come first.
You're in Hay today to celebrate 20 years of Rebus. When you wrote Knots and Crosses, which was the first Rebus novel, did you have any idea of how far the two of you were going to travel together?
Absolutely not, to the extent that I nearly bumped him off at the end of that first book. In the first draft, he died in a tunnel underneath the streets of Edinburgh. And something about him, even then, although I was thinking of him just as a one book, as one character for one book, there was something that just got beneath my skin. And so I decided he would live. Maybe I just liked him a bit too much. And then it was a couple of books later on, I'd written a thriller and a big fat conspiracy theory set in America, although I'd never been to America. And then my editor said some wise words to me. He said, whatever happened to that guy Rebus? I liked him. And so I brought him back for a second book and a third, and here we are 20 years later.
Yeah, 20 years and 17 novels, I think. Is that right?
I think it's 17. I've lost count, to be honest with you. I think it's 17. It might be 17 or 18, yeah. Yeah.
But he's changed quite a lot, hasn't he, over those 17 novels?
Well, he's changed for all kinds of reasons. I mean, number one, in the first book, I didn't know him that well, and I gave him certain traits that turned out to be less than useful. So, for example, he's a jazz fan. I thought that's what loner existential cops would listen to late at night when they went home from the job. I knew nothing about jazz, and so quite soon I decided that he would listen to 60s and 70s rock, which I did know a bit about. He's also too well read in the first book. He quotes from Walt Whitman and he reads Crime and Punishment every year. He's basically a thinly disguised literature student, which is what I was when I was writing that first book. But he's also changed because I decided that the books would exist in real time, the series would live in real time. So he ages. He goes from being 40 in book one. This year he's 60. So he has physically changed and he's learnt a lot from the cases that he's worked on. So in all kinds of ways, yes, he has evolved through the series, as hopefully have I.
Yes, and there's also that sort of contemporary feel that you're talking about there is also reflected in the subjects that you, particularly in the later novels, I think, have brought in, and politics plays a much bigger part in the later novels. What was it that made you decide to sort of turn him on the outside world in that way?
Well, about part of the way through the series, I mean, in the early books, he lives in Edinburgh, but the streets are fictional streets, and he works in a fictional police station, and he drinks in fictional bars. I was trying to fictionalise it, and I thought, why am I working so hard at this? I should write about the real city. But if you choose to write about the real city in real time, anything that happens in real, you know, the real world, you need to take account of. So, for example, if Rebus's police station ceases to operate as a police station, he's got to move to another one in the books because it happened in real life. When they started the Parliament, I thought, well, there's no way I can avoid the Parliament. It's just such a big deal for Edinburgh and for Scotland that it's got to be part of the books. And rather than just mention it in passing, you know, they're driving down Holyrood. Oh, look, we're passing the new Parliament building. Sort of off-the-cuff remark. I thought, I'll make it germane to the plot of one of the books. And also, I think, as I've got older and I've got kids, I think I'm more politicised. I think I look at the world now and I'm asking big questions of the world. What kind of mess are we in? How did we get here? And what can we do about it? And so I use Rebus, as I've always used as fiction, as a way of asking those questions, writing the questions down and trying to make sense of them that way.
Another big change that's happened to Rebus, that particularly comes out in this novel, The Naming of the Dead, is the far closer accommodation he's come to with his Moriarty figure, Cafferty. What made you decide to bring them together?
I needed a figure who would represent everything that's bad about the world, and so I invented a villain called Cafferty who runs Edinburgh under the guise of being a sort of fairly civilised businessman on the surface, but Rebus knows the truth. But the more I wrote about Cafferty, he was one of these characters who again got beneath my skin, a little bit like happened with Siobhan. She was meant to be just another colleague and became an equal partner with Rebus because I found her interesting and complex as a character. I thought there's an awful lot I can do with Cafferty. He and Rebus have got similar backgrounds. They're almost like Cain and Abel or Jekyll and Hyde. They're almost, you know, made from the same cloth. And it's just that Rebus at one point in his life went one way and Cafferty at a point in his life went another way. And so they have become, they've become adversaries, but they respect each other and there's a lot of empathy between them. And so it's become a very interesting relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has become a relationship that I really can't escape. And so Cafferty now has to be in every book because I can't imagine a book with Rebus in it without him. But that means you've got to have closure. So I'm very conscious that at the end of the series, with Rebus on the point of retirement, that there's some unfinished business there that needs to be taken care of.
Yeah, which leads me on to the other thing that I wanted to talk about to do with this novel, which is that for me it was by far the most melancholy of all of the novels. And I think that has to do with the sense that you're very aware as the novel progresses, because you keep mentioning it, that he has, you know, a year left in his job. He's coming up to retirement. He's going to be put out to pasture. And I'm scared for him that he won't know what to do with himself. I don't want to see him drinking his pension away in the Oxford bar.
Well, I mean, that's true. I don't want to see him drinking away his pension in the Oxford bar either, but the alternatives probably wouldn't appeal to him. I've just finished writing the next book, and I've just delivered it to my publisher, and he's thinking of, you know, he's thinking about Cop City New who've retired and they've gone to Marbella, or they're now driving taxis, or they've become landlords or whatever, and he just can't see himself doing any of these things. So, I mean, that is an unresolved question in the books as to how he will spend his retirement. Siobhan knows how he'll spend his retirement. Siobhan tells him in the new book, you'll just keep hassling me to find out what I'm up to and what cases are ongoing and see if you can help, and you'll always be sort of... You won't be able to let go of the job. And I think that's probably a truth. And yeah. That's the great thing about Rebus as a cop, is that he can never let go until he's got answers, until he's satisfied with the answers that he's got. So I think there is room for him to come back in a retirement book, because cops do that in real life. They come back to work cold cases.
Yeah.
And it happens in Scotland the same as in England and elsewhere. So there's room for him to come back even in retirement, because because the police know that he's a good detective. He might have his failings, he might have faults, and as a human being he might not be the best, but as a detective he's got a lot of strengths that they're going to lose when they lose him from the force.
So this isn't necessarily the end of Rebus then?
No, it's the final book in inverted commas, because it's the retirement book. He's 60, he's got to retire at 60, it's his retirment book. And in so far, I mean, I'm not quite finished it yet, because I'm sure my editor will come back with lots of changes she wants me to make, but so far he's made it to the end, alive and kicking.
So we've talked about the ways in which Rebus has changed over the 20 years in which you've been writing about him. How has writing about him changed you, would you say?
Well, I think each book I write is another part of the apprenticeship that I'm serving. That's, you know, I mean, the reason that writers keep writing books is because we fail to write the perfect book. Each book that we produce is yet another failure, another misfired attempt to write the perfect novel. And so we've got to try again. And if you do write the perfect novel, I think you sometimes stop, as happened with something like To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, or Catcher in the Rye. And so, you know... Although I'm getting closer to the heart of Rebus, I still don't know everything that makes him tick. He's still holding information back from me. There are still secrets about Edinburgh I don't know. There are still things about Cafferty and Siobhan I don't know. There are still big questions, big moral questions in my head that I need to keep writing books about in order to make sense of. Mm-hmm. And there are still things about Scotland that I want to explore. And whether I'm exploring them in crime fiction, whether I'm exploring them in an opera libretto, I've just finished writing my first opera libretto, I'm about to start writing a comic book. I've been writing a serial for an American newspaper set in Edinburgh, which is not Rebus. All these different things that, you know, I've been writing song lyrics for bands. These are all ways of sort of making sense of the world. So, I don't know. The thing is that every time I try writing something, it almost always comes back to crime. The serial for the American newspaper, they said, write about anything you want, turned out to be a heist. The opera, they said, write about anything you want. The first opera I wrote, the first libretto I wrote for them, was based in a police interview room with a detective and a suspect. So I'm not getting too far from my roots. And the reason for that, twofold. One, everything I want to say about the world, I seem to be able to say in the form of the crime novel. And two, I think the crime novel is a fantastic way of tackling these big moral issues and big questions about society and politics and everything else.
It puts everything to the forefront, doesn't it? It's text rather than subtext with the crime novel.
But the thing about the crime novel is that you can have a lot of polemic in there without people noticing it. If you've got a literary novel and it's about a subject, a theme, it tends to be there, you know, you can see the ribs of the theme sticking through. Because in a crime novel, you've got this roller coaster plot, you've got these exciting things happening, you've got twists and turns, and the reader always feels as though they're about to fall off the edge of a cliff. They don't notice that they're being asked big questions. They don't notice this book is dealing with big moral concerns or big political questions. So it's quite fun in a way, because you're actually disguising all that from the reader. You're not shoving it down their throats.
It's politics by the back door.
Politics by the back door, which is maybe why so many politicians like their crime fiction.
That was Sarah Crown speaking to Ian Rankin. That's about all from me today. Tomorrow we have a poetry special. Gillian Clark will be taking us to her favourite poetry bookstores. We'll be behind the scenes at the Poetry Gala. Plus, I'll be talking to Clive James. Don't forget, if you have any thoughts you want us to put to the authors, or you have any thoughts on the Haycast, email the producer, francesca.panetta@guardian.co.uk. And you can follow the Hay coverage online at guardian.co.uk/books/Hay2007, and of course, in the paper as well. I'm Safraz Manzor. The programme was produced by Francesca Panetta. The Haycast is back tomorrow. Until then, it's goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.